It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosie.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever. Yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosie.
Do it.
We're doing it.
We're doing it. Welcome to Film Sociology. Film lovers, hi. Already messed up the intro. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msosi@WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter at Matthew Sosie. The show is available as a podcast. It's also available on iTunes. And we have a blog, which you can check out at
filmsociology.tumblr.com.
The voice you just heard is a man who is frantically studying his draft picks. It's Kobe Slagle.
Hello.
Did you watch any of it last night?
I watched it. I wanted to see where Jadeveon went just because I'm so tired of hearing about him.
Not Johnny Manziel.
And I wanted to see where Johnny Manziel went, and I ended up watching the thing a lot longer than I intended on watching it.
And how did Fair Sweet Bianca, the co-star of I Love You, Your Team Sucks, feel about that?
She watched a couple picks and then called it. So
That's okay. That's right.
You don't need to watch this. You don't need to watch this thing. The Colts didn't. The Colts didn't even have a pick in the first round.
No, they did not. So I'm sure Indianapolis rating. You know what? Everybody's going to see Draft Day. No, they
didn't.
I was thinking if they had opened it last week, but then it would have been up against Spider-Man. That's not a good idea.
No.
Maybe the week before. Oh well, we'll never know. I like the Lions pick. I'm optimistic. Anyway, now that we're done with the sports portion of the film show, it's just intriguing the fact that the big news story involving the draft, and of course there was a film that came out over a month ago that...
Has it been that long?
You might have to check. I think it's probably been...
That's probably pretty close.
But, the question is, of course, where do you release it, I guess? I thought if they did it a little closer to the draft, it maybe would have created a buzz. But the big buzz last night was involving the Browns. So, by the way, Frank Langella does not own the Cleveland Browns. Just checking. And guys, if you're hanging around the Browns office, Jennifer Garner's not there.
Probably not.
As much as we would like that to happen, that's probably not going to happen.
I hope we get. I hope the internet gives us. Yeah.
As in film sociology.
Yeah. I hope the internet in the next couple of days gives us a new. Hastily made Cleveland tourism video.
You do like those, as does Emma.
Very good.
We sing in the style of the hastily made.
Mm-hmm.
So we will see. Now everyone.
Now their economy is based on
Johnny Manziel. Nice.
They said they sold in like the 12 hours overnight from when they picked it. Like it was like 9 or 10 something last night when they made their pick until like 10 o'clock this morning. In that span of 12 hours overnight, they sold 1,500 season tickets.
And how many jerseys do you think?
Jerseys are already printed.
And you know what? Kevin Costner says, you're welcome. All right. Opening in theaters today, we have a John Turturro film called Fading Gigolo. Turturro is directing it. He's also starring in it with Woody Allen, Sofia Vergara, Sharon Stone, and Liev Schreiber. And we have two films that I got to check. Now, just to let you know, a little later on in the show, you're going to hear my chat with Joel Hodgson. He's the creator and original host, of Mystery Science Theater 3000. And Joel is going to be at the Indie PopCon May 30th through June 1st. So you can go check out information on that. Go to indiepopcon.com, C-O-N.com. PopCon. So there's that. So we'll have a, I had a chat with him last week, and we'll preview that. And then I think we will have time. This past Wednesday was the 100th episode of Restaurant Impossible, of course, the official restaurant reality show of film sociology. I think that's fairly safe to say.
Yeah, that's pretty.
With our unofficial Food Network
regular contributor,
Robert Irvine.
Yes.
So congrats, Robert. On behalf of Emma and myself, we're happy to have been a part of the 3% of that show.
Yeah, so not having...
You are the 1%, you and Bianca.
Yes, not having done a food portion of film sociology the past few weeks, we're going to do a blowout here today and talk to Robert Irvine.
And we're going to go back, we're going to go into the archives, because we have like a fresh air level archive system here. But we're going to go back to the very first time I chatted with Robert Irvine, and of course that's when he said those famous words, "Call me anytime."
Deadly.
Thank you for that. Okay, opening in theaters today is a film, the latest film from Jim Jarmusch, and it's called Only Lovers Left Alive, and it stars Tilda Swinton and Tom Hiddleston.
What was that? What was that? Tom who?
Hiddleston.
Okay.
Loki. What'd you think?
I thought you had a stumble?
Like,
yeah.
You're just going to pounce on that, weren't you? Like sword buckling?
Not today.
Not today, pal. But, you know, show's still young. John Hurt is in it as well. We have Tom plays a musician living in an old gothic spooky house in Detroit. Not enough cinematic punchlines over Detroit, apparently. Thanks. Appreciate it. And as they said in the Hastily video, we're not Detroit. Anyway, he's a musician who has got a huge underground following, is often heard music-wise, but has never been seen. He's got a wife played by Tilda Swinton who is living overseas, and she wants him to come visit or vice versa. And after a long period of time of not seeing each other, they reunite, and it feels so good. And later on in the film, you have John Hurt, who's an old friend of theirs, who's slowly dying, and then her sister shows up. And just as you know, when the sister-in-law shows up, it's, you know, trouble happens.
Various chicanery.
So all that, I forgot to tell you, they're vampires. Ta-da.
Oh, this is the...
You saw the trailer for this?
No, I don't know, maybe. I can't remember. I'm going to have to look it up real quick here.
Which you'll look up on radio live.
Yeah.
Okay. Jim Jarmusch, of course, is the guy who gave us films like Down by Law. Yeah, those aren't props. You know, Down by Law, Ghost Dog, Dead Man. And I can't remember, Ed Johnsonat and I were talking, and I think he I can't remember where he got the source, but it was described as, Jarmusch's films are described as what looks like deleted scenes from a DVD put together and made into a film. It is... I guess there's one way of putting it has been called, I lift this name from the non-nouveau, atmospheric. Not a whole lot of plot things happening in this, Mr. Slagle. Lots of character things.
This is a vampire movie?
Yes, and it doesn't look it. Now does it? You know why? They're not glittery.
There is nothing about anything about the poster here or...
Could you imagine putting vampire in the description of this film? And who would go and who would be really disappointed that it's not something they've already seen?
Fading gigolo vampire.
Yeah. So anyway, it's more about this couple. It's one of my favorite descriptions of a film. The just so happens. They just so happen to be vampires.
Okay. I was just about to ask, is it relevant that they are vampires or just like a little thing that's thrown
no,
in?
No, it is. It's not thrown in. But it's excuse me. You know what? These guys, they'd eat at Taste. We know you love that.
Yeah.
It's a slow-paced film, but it's not slow. It's more about them. It's at times treated, blood is treated more like a drug and an addiction. I got a little bit of flashbacks of the Abel Ferrara film, The Addiction. But it's more about their relationship. And what they do with each other, as well as what they need to do in order to survive. So It's not Fair Sweet Bianca's vampire movie, which means you guys should go see this immediately. So I can get berated because I suggested this. It's low key. It's nice. It's nice work from Swinton and from Tom Hiddleston. John Hurt's in this as well, as I said, Anton Yelchin and Jeffrey Wright, among others. So, and you get a part of Detroit, boy, that's never been shown in a movie before. Never, never, never. Sarcasm. So, anyway. If you like Jarmusch's films, I think you're going to like this. I enjoyed it. Cleansing the palate of vampire movies. You know who you are. You should go check this out.
Now that was a good movie.
Also opening in theaters today is Neighbors, which is already being praised highly as the next R-rated gross-out comedy. Putting it in the same category as, say, The Hangover or Old School. And this is Seth Rogen and Zac Efron and Rose Byrne. This time around, Rogan plays the semi-respectable one. He is a married man with a brand new child, brand new daughter, and the house next door is bought out by a fraternity run by Zac Efron. You with it so far?
Yeah.
You all right over there?
Oh, well, I'm.
You're still looking.
I couldn't remember what. I've seen trailers, but I can't remember anything about the trailers.
Yeah. Well, you know, family, frat house, wackiness will ensue.
Okay.
R-rated wackiness will ensue.
All right.
So I heard an interview with Rogan this week and another I won't say where. But apparently they were pushing this film to be the next big quotable comedy like Caddyshack or Animal House. And I ask, Mr. Slager, is that really a goal for a film? Should that be the main goal? Maybe the secondary goal, but not the main goal. It kind of feels like when
you can set out to do that.
Yeah.
That's not something that you can just say you're going to do and do it. That's something that happens by virtue of the material in the movie being good and being funny.
So where does Anchorman fall in that?
On what, like the all time
list? I think it's somewhere in the middle of that where it have it. Do you see where I'm getting at? I guess what I'm saying is, yeah, as you said, you can't create a sensation. You can't specifically create a sensation, just like you can't create a cult film. Great case in point, Snakes on a Plane.
Mm-hmm.
They were definitely going to make this a cult film to a mainstream audience. Well. The studio doesn't decide if it's going to be a cult film or a midnight movie
right.
or not. It just happens.
The audience decides.
The audience
everything.
Decides. So, you know, so the question is, are we going to be quoting? Are we going to be quoting Neighbors in like a month?
I don't know.
And I think Anchorman to a certain degree, and especially Anchorman 2.
Now I can see Anchorman 2 working toward that.
Yeah.
I don't view Anchorman though as set out to do that. I view Anchorman as a standalone piece that ended up being. In my mind, completely hilarious.
Phenomenal.
But then I've not seen Anchorman 2 in the way that...
It's too long.
Everybody has described Anchorman 2 and talked about Anchorman 2. And the things that have come out after Anchorman and after Wedding Crashers and after 40-Year-Old Virgin and all those, you know, 10 years ago, it is as if you're trying to replicate what you got in Anchorman and what you got in those three movies. And it's very obviously trying too hard.
Right. And in some cases, it's interesting. This film, Neighbors, has two credited screenwriters, and it feels like a big chunk of it is improvised. So, now, it's one thing where, you know, and Anchorman was the same way. You I think on the DVDs and the Blu-rays, even in the closing credits, you see them riff 8, 9, 10
yeah.
things. And then, of course, they take the best one out of it. So, a lot of this feels... improvised, and they wanted to do something more than just the grumpy neighbor and the crazy frat guys. And I think they were trying to do that and try to break that mold by having Seth Rogen play it, because he's still playing kind of a man child. And there's a little bit where the couple who now have a child and they love the child, but they kind of wish they could go back to their old lifestyle.
So it's the couple that wishes they could go back, not necessarily just Seth
correct,
Rogen.
Correct. And so it started to go into
that's a little bit of a different take.
It started going into This Is 40 territory a little bit for me, and that was going to really make me upset because I hated that film. age, deal with it. And so, by the way, and there are moments like that. There's a scene where the married couple go into the frat house. Kobe, mm-hmm. as you get older, when you enter a house or a party, you don't walk in slow motion, and hip-hop music might be playing, but it's not in a film sense of the atmosphere. Just be aware.
I imagine walking in slow motion and Fantastic Voyage by Lakeside.
I bet you do. Yeah. Any of the film sociology music for me? So there's that. There's a lot of, because there's a fraternity. And by the way, they do make fun of young parents, which, you know, everything is geared around the child, but they also want their own lives back. But there is a little bit of that. There is a little bit of making fun of the brotasm of fraternities.
Okay.
And Efron gets to, I think, make fun of. I think he does that pretty well. There's a lot of jokes in here, and there's a lot of grown-up adult things happening in this film. I think there's a lot of shots that are made. For me, I would be interested in seeing what you think of the film, because this is a film which reminds me of old school and kind of every R-rated gross and Hangover, every gross-out comedy since then. Mm-hmm. I probably would like this if I was 10 years younger or 20 years younger. And so I'd be intrigued to see what a younger person thinks.
I don't know.
And
looking at the time here, we got a 96-minute runtime, so we're not slogging through.
No, thank God it's not longer. But that being said, I did laugh. I did laugh out loud at some moments. And but the film is a mess between wanting to make fun of the frats, make fun of the couples, make them a feuding and all, having these kind of jackass level pranks pulled on each other with various results of chicanery and hilarity.
Is that pretty much where we end up? Is the couple, the grown-up couple, is pranking the frat guys,
yeah.
and the frat guys are pranking the couple,
yep.
and will they ever get along? And
yeah,
when,
exactly.
Who's going to draw the line?
Right.
Okay.
I can already tell you're not going.
I don't know. I mean,
it's okay. It's okay. People, I know there's going to be younger people that like it way more than I will.
Does Seth Rogen do his Seth Rogen thing?
What is the Seth Rogen thing?
oh, man. Well, I have a feeling he does.
So I guess you answered your own question. Yeah, only this time he's a responsible parent, even though he wants to go hang out at the frat house in one sequence and then goes to war with them in another.
I didn't like Old School.
Okay. I thought Old School was okay. Wasn't the best comedy ever. So.
No. But there are people my age that are
they
just
swear by
crazy.
That.
Yeah.
That's what they want to do when they get to my age. Good luck with that. Don't be that. Anyway.
College isn't like that.
No, it's not. Sorry.
No.
And neither is this. So, all right. I think, do we have a response? That's all right. that's a no. We need to, we still need to work on mediocre.
Yeah, I know.
Mediocre responses. Okay. Let's move on. Full disclosure, I have to take off at the end. So Kobe's going to land the plane. So we're going to go to my chat with Joel Hodgson, the creator of Mystery Science Theater 3000, who is going to be at Indy PopCon the weekend of May 30th through June 1st. I think he's there all 3 days. Double check that. So go to IndyPopCon.com. You can also go to JoelHodgson.com. He's also on Twitter at Joel G. Hodgson. Of course, again, the creator of Mystery Science Theater 3000. And it was fun to chat with him. I didn't turn entirely into the Chris Farley show. Came close. You were missing. You were with the robots,
guys.
That was awesome. Yeah, not quite. But I mean, this guy helped. This guy and his show and his humor and the writers and the other actors in the series helped carve out a niche in the Soucy family, a foundation of snarky humor. And we're not the only ones, but it's the only ones in this room. So and the Slagles. The family of two and a cat. So anyway, so here's my chat with Joel Hodgson from Mystery Science Theater 3000. Tell us a little bit about riffing myself, because I know you'll be riffing yourself at Indie PopCon.
Yes, there's two versions of riffing myself. There's the public riffing myself, which is at 5:30 on Friday, and that's May 30th. Oh, wait. Yeah, 5:30. And then I do behind riffing myself, which is a more in-depth VIP event at 3 p.m. on Saturday. So in Riffing Myself, it's basically the creation story of Mystery Science Theater, all the influences, all the things I saw growing up, and all of, you know, everything from the music I was listening to the books I was reading. And it's lots of pictures. So, yeah.
So how long have you been preparing this one-man show? And you have two versions of it.
Oh, man. You know, I did it. It probably took me, I don't know, it probably took me 3-4 months to put together. And then the last year I've been traveling with it. I've probably done 12 or 14 cities and performed it all over the place. So, yeah, something like that.
So how has it changed from the first time you did it in front of an audience?
Well, you learn how to, you know, it's funny, it's like anything. You learn how to lean into certain things. You learn what are the things they really like, what are the things they really want to hear, what are the things that are important to say but they don't really care about, that kind of lead up to the more important things. So it's all kind of an act of massaging all those elements so it flows and it feels like a show, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like you just work. You know, always the live audience is kind of your best collaborator for making stuff.
I always thought of Mystery Science Theater as kind of a television version of jazz, and I think in this case you're getting to do a solo performance.
I like that. Well, that's a really nice thing to say. I appreciate that. And you know, the act of riffing comes from, you know, the name comes from a jazz riff. You know, the idea of, you know, reacting to something and being, you know, kind of in the moment. So, yeah, it's really, I really like that analogy. It's kind of like that, again, you know, with Riffing Myself, it's really a story, so it's me presenting it with lots of pictures. And I do, obviously, once I put up the pictures, I riff on them, but it's a little different. It's not me riffing on a movie by myself.
Right. Yeah, because with Mystery Science Theater, you know, the movie is different, the riffs are different, the audience reaction is different, whether, you know, we're watching at home. You know, you always hear people say, you know, some episodes are better than others. And I'm sure from your point of view, some Riffing Myself were better than others, depending on certain cities.
Oh, it's really true. You know, there's so many variables at work. I mean, it's the audience, it's the way I feel while, and you know, and then the thing that's beyond that is just what's happening together with everybody in the room, you know. So it's really true. You can't know, and that's why people like it. And I think that's why people get addicted to performing, is it's never the same, you know. You can tweak it and you can work on it and kind of affect the outcome, hopefully make it better each time and make it flow better each time. But, yeah.
Now, you said there's a VIP version of this. Can you give us a little insight on how that is going to differ? I mean, you said more in-depth, more anecdotes maybe, stuff that's
Well, yeah. I mean, mostly it's a lot of – it's kind of – you know, it's really has an open structure where people can stop me at any time and ask questions. And that isn't the case when I do it, you know, the other more public version. That's really a performance. And so the VIP version is, oh, wait, I want to hear more about this. Stop, you know, they can raise their hand and stop me and kind of go deeper, you know. It's more interactive, I think.
And I guess you've been riffed already?
Well, you mean people riffing? You mean people like, I think, are you thinking of like hecklers?
Not necessarily heckler. I think even on the street, how often do you get people yelling quotes at you, yelling riffs at you?
Oh, that doesn't happen too much. I mean, you know, it's funny. I feel like it was really peculiar, but right after the show, you know, it's been a long time since the show's been on. It's been 15 years. And I think while the show was on, I think people would get in that headspace and believe that, like, I was the guy. Like, that's me.
Right.
And I'm not like a guy who has, there's like 8 writers in the room and we're all creating stuff. You know, they think Joel's the embodiment of that. And so I think that happened a lot more in the past. People now, I think, everybody's kind of settled into what it is and knows what it is. And because I do events like Indie Pop Con, you know, people have access to me, so they can kind of meet me. So it doesn't happen that much as you'd think. I think, you know, also we produce so much material, you know, like 700, 800 riffs per movie, that a lot of times it's possible they're saying stuff and I just don't recognize it. I don't remember it. So that maybe that's it. Maybe they're doing that, but I'm not getting it.
Right. I think it's almost like Shakespeare as far as introducing new things to as far as everyday speak. I mean, I still say occasionally to come up to people and ask them, any of you do Pez?
Oh, that's funny. I think so. You know, I have to say it's so embedded in me. I'll give you an example. I just watched the Mystery Science Theater riff on Sinbad. And or the final voyage of Sinbad or whatever it was. I don't remember. But I did a show with Cinematic Titanic, and I had the guy, there's a character who's sitting alone, and I had him sing Where Is Love from the musical Oliver.
Yeah.
And people laughed really hard, and they loved it. But I didn't realize it was a riff from Mystery Science Theater. I'd done the same joke 15 years earlier, 20 years earlier, and didn't realize it. So it's kind of like, it's so kind of, because when you're writing the show, it's a show about everything. And so you put everything in and you kind of don't know when the show stops and you begin or end. You know, it's kind of like it's all in there. There's just stuff, stuff from just peculiar things from that just happen. You know, the conversations, like a lot of it is us kind of mimicking the look on somebody's face. And that just comes from conversations you've heard people have or people have said to you. So it's all embedded in that show. And so I have to say, you know, like I said, I don't really know when you know, exactly when that happens, where I stop and when the show starts. It's weird.
My daughter is 12. And when she was younger, she referred to it as the daddy movies with the funny robots.
And
now the way I get her out of bed is I will get right into her ear and start to vocalize the theme from Manos, which she said is the worst thing she's ever experienced.
Oh, that's hilarious. That's so great. I know I have to say, you know, there's moments when it just, you know, I'm having so much fun because I'm going back and watching them. And it's like there was one that just made me laugh out loud. Completely forgot about it since Sinbad, and it, this movie is great, and it's got all this energy to it. It's just a huge production, but there's this great big feast they're having with jesters and tumblers and kings, and it's just packed. It's dense, and Sinbad says, "I've been all around the world, and this is the stupidest thing I've ever seen." And it, as simple as that is, it just cracked me up. I laughed out loud at it, and it's really funny. So I'm starting to understand what it's like for people on the outside of it, you know, like what it feels like watching it for the first time, because so much time has gone by.
With the box set, I know you're often on there doing intros and doing the documentaries. How long a stretch do they film those, or how many sessions do you have to go and be filmed for the collections?
They only do it one at a time, usually, or sometimes they'll do pickups and go, oh, we planned far enough in advance where we're going to have you do a section for the next box set. But usually the box sets are recorded one at a time. They're not in series.
Okay. If somebody were to start watching Mystery Science Theater, is there an episode that you would say this is 101?
Oh, you know, I'm really not the guy to do that.
Okay.
I feel like the way I look at them is so different because I'm like the puppeteer, you know, so it's like I don't really get, like, I can't really get that great impression. I know, you know, based on, I've surveyed people on my Twitter feed and asked them, like when we did Turkey Day last year, I asked them their favorite movies. Some of them that keep coming up are things like Mitchell. People love Mitchell. They love Werewolf. I'm going to try to think. They say people like Pod People really a lot. I'm trying to remember the other one. Something in Space. It's a Mike episode.
When going through the library, because we hear the story of the films that are in the library, you know, as far as the video collection, was there ever a film that was known or semi-known, but it just wasn't show material?
Well, we didn't want to do Plan 9. I remember that because that was famous for being a bad movie. And so, you know, we kind of felt that was too on the... You know, we felt like somebody had already found that movie and called it out and said, this is like a terrible movie. This is the worst movie ever made. So that was one that we deliberately didn't do. But other movies that we found, once we found a movie that would work, we felt would work, we really wanted it. We worked really hard to get them. So we didn't like survey movies that we couldn't get. It wasn't like we went on Netflix and looked for movies and said, oh, can we get this one? You know,
right.
It's like they had been screened by lawyers in New York, and we got boxes of VHSs that had been, they knew that they could get the rights to, or that it was likely.
I still have a paperback copy of the Golden Turkey Awards, and I would always look for titles, especially with you guys. If I remember, like, Creeping Terror or other films that I've always read about but never got a chance to see, and you guys put a lot of check marks in that book for me, so thank you.
Oh, yeah, well, you know, the Turkey Awards was really influential. I saw that when I was in college, you know, probably like 1981, and that had a huge influence on me. That's actually something I talk about in Riffing Myself, where I go, why isn't anybody making a show with these movies? You know, that was basically the moment where I realized, oh, yeah, like, well, I don't get these, you know, these things are hugely entertaining. Why isn't someone exploiting that? So, yeah, that book looms really large in the story.
Who was your local horror show host? Did you watch that growing up?
Yeah, there was a show out of Madison called, I grew up in Wisconsin, so there's a show in Madison called Ferdy's Inferno. There was a show in Milwaukee called Nightmare Theater. And there was like a really weird character named Toulouse Nonek. He was like a headless guy. That was one of the characters. And then in Green Bay, it was a show called Erie Street, and the host's name was Alexander. He was a vampire.
Shifting gears a little bit, what films, new or old, it doesn't matter, but what films do you like to watch leisurely at home where you don't have to riff?
Oh, man, I'm like everybody. I like every time I watch a movie for entertainment, I want to be taken away by it. I want to watch it and enjoy it and... like, I watched the Captain America movie. I really liked it, The Winter Soldier. I thought it was really good, and it did just exactly what I was hoping it would. Just kind of, I forget, I cease to be myself, and I'm Captain America, you know.
Do you get recognized in theaters often?
You mean by the shape of my head?
I didn't say that, but...
you know what? That's only happened once, and it was really funny. It was at the place where CineFamily has their residency now in L.A. It was the Silent Movie Theater, and that was the first time and only time I was ever recognized by the back of my head. Somebody sat behind me, tapped me on the shoulder, and said, are you the guy from MSP? So, yeah. But it doesn't happen too much. I think occasionally people will pick me out, but I really praise them for being especially gifted and having a good eye. Mm-hmm. I happen to be one of those people. I have really good facial pattern recognition, and so when I used to live in L.A., I'd be able to pick out celebrities all the time, and people with me just wouldn't see them. Mm-hmm. So there are people that are gifted at that, but it's not very often.
Now, I read in the Wired article there was something that was alluded to, that there's going to be some form of reunion, reboot. Can you elaborate on that?
I can't really. That was a leak a little early, so I can't really say anything about it now.
That was worth a shot.
Yeah.
Matt's conversation with Mystery Science 3000 creator Joel Hodgson. He is going to be at Indie Pop Con. More info on that at IndiePopCon.com, May 30th through June 1st, downtown at the Indiana Convention Center. We were talking a little bit earlier about this past Wednesday marked the 100th episode of the Food Network program Restaurant Impossible, hosted by film sociology regular contributor Robert Irvine. So today, in honor of the milestone for Chef Irvine, we're going back in time. Here is Matt's first conversation with Chef Irvine. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show on WFYI HD To The Point and WFYI.org.
Joining me on Film Sociology is a chef, television personality, and a gentleman who can crack walnuts with his biceps, Chef Robert Irvine. How are you, sir?
I'm good. And yourself?
Hanging in there. Not as much snow as you guys, but we're doing okay.
Well, yeah, I mean, at least we didn't get, well, where I am in Hilton Head, there's not much. It did snow, but when I was in New York, I think we got like 8 inches, 12 inches to a drifts of 8 foot and crazy stuff.
Indeed. Well, this is a busy month for you because you have not one but two television programs that you're involved with. Let's start with Worst Cooks in America. Did you watch the first season, and did you know how far ahead did you know that you were going to be involved with the show?
Well, funny enough, about a year prior to the season one, we talked about it, and it never happened for me based on other things that were going on. And I saw season one and loved it because it's real, you know. Mm-hmm. And when they asked me to do season two, I was obviously very excited because I'd never done something where you're training people one-on-one except in my restaurants or in the Navy. So I was very excited to do it and to work with Anne Burrell.
It seemed like you were the right choice. Funny you bring that up because watching you on Dinner Impossible, you've had people help you that – well, they're not always the sharpest knife in the drawer.
Yeah, it's interesting. Dinner Impossible is so real, and it's so, you know, and I always say it's the most real reality show on television because I really know nothing, and I find people who want to work with me, or they don't, whichever the case may be, and I sort of bring them in. And if they've never picked up a knife before, I expect great things from them, and I push them. And you can see that on Dinner Impossible when they get annoyed with me or they get upset with me. But, you know, we've got a job to do in a very short period of time to get it done, and there's no time for excuses or attitudes. We just get it done.
How's it been working with Chef Anne, and how much did you know her before getting involved with the show?
I didn't know Anne very well because, you know, I do my own thing around the country. Anne's show is set in a studio, and they tape all year. For me, I travel the country, so I didn't know Anne very well, only from the season one. And to work with her, she's a very intense person. She was a great tutor. You know, she was a culinary instructor before she became a chef. Mm-hmm. And she's very intense. You know, you think I'm the tough guy. In fact, I think she's tougher than me. I'm looking like the pussycat here, and she's like the ogre. But a fun, fun-loving person. And when you see the show, you'll know that we banter back and forth. She doesn't like to lose. She doesn't like to lose anything. She doesn't like, you know, she's a New York, what's the word I look for? One word, snap you in half person. She can stop a man in his tracks by saying one thing. And it's funny because as a gentleman that I am, I will never argue with a woman. So it's very, very interesting to see the dynamic between Anne and myself.
Did you have a strategy going in on how to work with these people?
Strategy, no. I just, you know, my military training is all about leadership. And what I wanted to do with, of course, Anne picked my team and I picked her team.
Right.
So what I wanted to do was be hard or firm, but nurturing at the same time. And that's very unusual for me from a DI standpoint, a Dinner Impossible standpoint. But I really had to understand each individual person and where they come from and their life and all them things that I don't really get into on Dinner Impossible. And then I could break them down one by one and say, okay, she's got this strength, he's got this strength. And just be firm and sort of, you know, hey, I'm your friend, but I'm also your teacher. Mm-hmm. And if you don't get this right or you don't do your homework, you're going to be going home. So strategy was always to win and be the better teacher.
What was the oddest thing you've had to eat with the show?
The oddest thing I had to eat? Oh, my word. There were so many things. Burnt chicken, shepherd's pie,
Uh-oh.
Somebody brought in, which is one of my favorite dishes, and I couldn't eat it. It was so bad. Chicken that had been cooked for 19 hours. Meatballs that were made with Twizzlers. Just some horrific stuff. And these people thought it was great.
Now, after this, do you go home and make it just to make things right?
Make things right. food is supposed to be fun, and you're allowed to make mistakes. But there are a few basic things you need to follow, you know? And I think after this eight-week period of doing with cooks, these people that were either on at the end of the show or got let go early, they all learned something to go home and continue to cook. And I think all of them, all 16 of them, are still continuing to cook. I still talk to some of them, Facebook and whatnot. And they found a new love. It's not out of a frozen container or a can. So I'm excited that they've gone on and done that.
Excellent. Now, I know, as you alluded to, you have a show coming up called Restaurant Impossible. What happened with the changing from one format to another?
It's very different. You know, Restaurant Impossible is almost like Dinner Impossible times three. Because I'm calm. I have to learn about the property that's going bankrupt. You know, the basic outline of the show is there's a bankrupt restaurant or about to go bankrupt. I have 36 hours or 2 days to turn it around, $10,000 to make it look new, remarket it, retrain the people, cooks and front of the house, re-put a new menu, and all this is done after I meet the owners, and then I ban the owners from the actual restaurant, so they never see the restaurant again or what I'm going to do to it until we reopen it 36 hours later. And normally to 200 or 300 reservations with a new menu, a new look, decor, new menus, new everything. So it's unlike Dinner Impossible or Worst Cooks. If somebody on Dinner Impossible, if I fail, you know, there's no real sort of after effects except my ego. Worst Cooks, somebody goes home. But restaurant is somebody's life and livelihood. Mm-hmm. You know, do you lose your restaurant? You lose all the money you put into it. And when you see these shows that we've just shot, I mean, two 30-year-old kids putting $1 million into a restaurant and running a 50% food cost and payroll, $1 million. You know, these are people's lives. So you get all them emotions of happiness, frustration, anger. When I first meet them, they're, oh, we're doing everything right. Well, no, you're not, because you're going bankrupt. So it's, you know, the first 8 hours, they want to fight you and they want to argue with you. And then once you see that I'm trying to help them and teach their staff, then it's suddenly I become their friend. Mm-hmm. You know, their staff always want to fight you and they're doing everything perfect. But when I show them what they're doing wrong and then how to fix that, it's amazing the transformation of their attitude.
How much downtime did you get between restaurants when you were filming that?
Not very much, about a week between each restaurant. And we were in Delaware, St. Louis, North Carolina, New Jersey. I mean, it's a hectic schedule because this year, obviously, I've done an awful lot of filming. We finished filming Dinner Impossible in June. I went straight into 8 weeks of filming in New York with Worst Cooks and straight from that into restaurants. Mm-hmm. And in between, we shot Iron Chef and Celebrity Chop. And a lot of other shows that are airing are coming up soon.
Mm-hmm. Was there a recurring theme as to what was wrong with the restaurants that you took care of?
Yeah, I think everybody believes that, you know, they can run a restaurant and run a restaurant well, even if they've had no experience. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't run kitchens well. They don't market correctly. They don't. You know, a restaurant has to be revamped every 3 years, whether it be decor, menus. I change my menu in my restaurant every 5 weeks. So you've got to keep it fresh and keep people coming back. And you know, one of the restaurants we did in Mystic, Connecticut, I mean, the carpet had probably been down there like 40 years.
Oh.
You know, and it was old and outdated, and the menu was old and outdated, and they forget to change with the times.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, new restaurants open in the vicinity of these places, and they've got exciting food, they've got vibrant drinks, they've got, you know, light music, and they're taking all that, them type of businesses away. So it's just interesting to see that everybody has the same format, different places. Mm-hmm. I don't scream and shout and say, you suck and you do this. That's not what this is. I go in, I evaluate based on what I see and what I think this place should be and the surrounding area. I say, okay, this is what I think. I've been with a designer. I say, okay, this is what I want for this restaurant. How do you make this happen? We got $10,000. We got no sleep. And in 36 hours, we open this restaurant. Now I've got to market this, put it on radio stations, which I do because I love radio. It hits so many people so fast. And you get the word out so quickly. So we do a lot of radio stuff, a lot of chamber of commerce things to try and get the word out about this restaurant that people wouldn't normally know about. So it's really life-saving of not only health, but revamping their life, you know, mm-hmm. which is very meaningful to me.
When you,
a very different side of Robert Irvine.
Well, I mean, I think from the first impressions, especially with the beginning of Dinner Impossible, we see the aggressive, you know, forward moving, and but seeing you work, like I remember, my daughter has the DVD of you cooking with kids on the Ratatouille DVD, and you know, working on Battle Sugar, which is now apparently a holiday tradition on Food Network.
Yes, that was an amazing show. I mean, that show, if you think about it, was shot 3 years ago. And it's still one of the most viewed things on YouTube for Food Network, which is hilarious to me because it was such a great show and it's timeless.
Mm-hmm.
The Ratatouille, and that is so funny you just brought it up. I was just talking about that with some friends of mine. You know, we did when we put Ratatouille to DVD, John Lasseter and myself and Brad Bird in Los Angeles, we shot, the Food Network shot a thing where I cooked for two brother and sister from New Jersey,
mm-hmm.
and we did crepes, and it was so much fun because I believe that children obviously are a future of culinarians, but also fitness and things like that. You know, I worked out this morning in the gym with every morning like I do, and there was four children there. They couldn't have been more than 8 years old, all doing push-ups and running around. And what a great way, fitness and food. And yes, that's the side of me. You know, I have a dad, and I love kids. And that's the side you don't really see from Dinner Impossible because you see this guy who's got to get this mission done,
mm-hmm.
and not fail. And that's unfortunately, some people see that, you know, they're going to the show halfway through, and they're like, oh, he's really aggressive, or he's, you know, until they really understand what the show is.
Mm-hmm.
And you get, it's funny, you get judged on that TV show, which is fine. I'm a very tough person in the kitchen, and I make no mistake and have no apologies for that. But the people that I've worked with and turned out and they don't have to do their things are executive chefs in their own right, and they call me every day or in factory or, you know, say, oh, look at this menu, what do you think? And that to me is amazing that I have that depth. You know, I have 5-year-old children, 9-year-olds. In fact, next week I have 2 cancer children, victims, patients, I should say, not victims, come over and make a wish to cook with me in my restaurant on Hilton Head for a week. You know, and people don't get to see that side of Robert Irvine, and I think Worst Cooks and Restaurant Impossible will show that side of me a little bit.
Well, and, you know, you got a sous chef in Indianapolis waiting for you. She's only 9, but she's willing.
I'm going to tell you, you have to get on a plane. You have to bring her to my restaurant. It would be awesome.
She loves travel. That shouldn't be a problem. Shifting gears for a little bit. When it comes to watching movies, can you watch a film that's set in a restaurant, or is it too grating? Are you taking too many notes?
I love movies. I am a huge movie. You know, in the last month, I've watched Salt, The Town. I just love movies. Red. I get so absorbed into the characters of what goes on, and especially if it's historic or if it's action. I'm a big action guy, obviously, you know, I'm a guy. But I can watch a movie and not worry about it for 2 hours. In fact, normally what I do is I take 2 movies back to back, and I say, okay, I'll watch,
one and we'll come out of the movie theater, get a Coke or something, and then go back and watch the other one. That's my relief of stress working out as well. I just love movies.
How'd you enjoy Red?
I loved it. Great cast.
Yep.
And one of the things about it, when you get a great bunch of people on a movie, the movie can, you know, the script can be not as strong, but because you enjoy them movies, or them people, you enjoy that movie. I watched that Unstoppable with
Denzel.
Denzel Washington, who was absolutely amazing. Mm-hmm. And my heart was pounding the whole way through that.
It was.
It was just an awesome movie. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, movies and food are good.
Well, what do you make around the house a snack on when it's movie night at the Irvine House? Stuff that you can't get in the at the movie theaters?
No, I'm a big believer in sweet popcorn, you know, candy popcorn. I love it. I do chocolate raisins. I do egg sandwiches. I'm a freak. I take poached eggs and make sandwiches out of it, you know.
Uh-huh.
But really just, I don't do soda that much. I do a lot of water and a couple of beers now and again. But I just love to pick a food. Mm-hmm. Popcorn is my absolute favorite, but it can't be buttered. I don't like that butter stuff. It's got to be caramel for me. Yeah, and I normally freeze my chocolate. So if I had like Snickers or Twixes, or I put them in the freezer for a couple of days, and then I eat them frozen. Love it.
Well, did I read right? You grew up in Wiltshire?
Yes.
What was the
Wiltshire, England, yeah.
Wiltshire. What was the name of the movie house in your neighborhood?
We didn't have, there's no name in the movie house. What it is, okay. In Salisbury itself, which is an old war town, you know, it's very historic. It used to be the mayor's house, and they made it into this movie theater that had six movie theaters, you know, in one.
Mm-hmm.
And it was called the Wolfpack. And I used to go there when I was a child, you know, on a Saturday mornings, they would have, like, you know, kids for X amount of pounds. And you could go in and watch movies from 8 o'clock till 3 o'clock in the afternoon. You know, straight through, they would just keep running movies. You know, so it was a great place. It was a great place to sit and eat garbage, meet your friends, and watch movies that you had fed up with them, you know?
Do you remember what some of the films were?
Oh, jeez. No. I mean, I am so old now. I'm 45 years old now. I was a kid. I was 8 years old.
Yeah, but I remember what I saw when I was 7 and 8.
Really?
Yeah.
I can't remember what I saw last week. That is funny. I mean, I only just watched, and you just heard me. I only just watched the Unstoppable. I don't remember Denzel Washington's name. You know, it's just. Oh, what did I also see? Johnny Depp and Angelina Jolie.
The Tourist.
The is it the American?
The Tourist.
Oh, Tourist. The
yeah.
Tourist. I just watched that too.
You enjoyed that?
Yeah, I did. I enjoyed it. I did enjoy it. A little slow to start with, but. I did enjoy it because I figured it out before, you know, the
right.
end.
Right. So
I like it when I figure it out and I'm not stumped.
Well, with your memories, so I'll cross off the history of Hammer Horror and Cliff Richard. Those are out. That's okay.
Cliff Richard. Now, there's a name from the past.
My daughter loves Summer Holiday. We have a British telly club here at WFYI, and we showed as a like on a Sunday afternoon we showed it to members as a, you know, kind of a thank you gift, and my daughter was 4 and she's dancing to Cliff Richard in the back of the auditorium, and I thought and she, of course, you know, she asked if we could buy these and I went yeah sure, so a new generation.
Yeah, on the bus, I remember that. Yep. Right, we went on the bus.
That's right.
And there's one scene, if I recall right, that they stood on top of a hill.
Yep.
Looking over something.
Well, and the guy who directed that, it was Peter Yates, who would later do Bullet and Breaking Away and do, you know, action films. And Herbert Ross, who's a famous choreographer, did the choreography. I thought it was just going to be 2 hours of twisting at a discotheque, and it was much more than that. So,
well, if you know any of these people, I want to do a movie too. I think I'd be a good action figure. I don't know.
How come you didn't get into the Expendables? Every other guy was. Of course, you're under the ages.
I mean, look at the size of them and who they are. I mean,
yeah, just because they're under 60.
Hey, listen, I'm just a cook on the Food Network. Just remember that. But I would love to do a movie. I did a little stint on Drop Dead Diva with Paula Abdul. Uh-huh. Where I was playing myself in a dream of hers making french fries, but acting to a script. It was kind of funny. But I would love to have a shot at doing a movie.
It's possible.
I don't think I'd be any good at it, but I would love to do it.
Come on.
I can look the part, right?
Oh, absolutely. You got the guns.
Hey, listen, if Dwayne Johnson can do it and Stone Cold Steve Austin and all these guys, I think I can do it.
And you handle wrestlers in the kitchen. We saw that.
Yeah. We had wrestlers in the kitchen. Gail Kim. I had The Miz. And, Faxino. That was hilarious.
We'll work on that. We'll work on, chef by day and crime fighter by night. We'll work on
there
your cape.
There you go. And I can't wait to see Green Hornet. I kind of like that, too.
Cool.
I haven't seen it yet, but I can't wait to see that.
And if you do a buddy cop film with Helen Mirren, I'm there.
Oh, I watched Helen Mirren when I was growing up, and she did Prime Suspect was the name of the show.
Oh, sure.
And I was, mesmerized by this show. And she has always been such an amazing actress and everything she's done, the Queen and all that sort of stuff. Just amazing how one person can immerse themselves and become that person. I also watched, Facebook or social media.
Oh,
which
yep.
I thought was another great movie.
And has the King's Speech come down to your neck of the woods?
No, not yet.
Definitely worth checking out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
Who's that?
Colin Firth as Colin Firth, Helena Bonham Carter, Jeffrey Rush. It's the king who has the stutter. During beginning of World War II.
Yeah, I know. No, I've seen it.
George VI.
I just haven't. I haven't seen it anywhere around here. But I normally end up in a major city somewhere. That's the fun part.
Well, Chef Irvine, thank you so much for taking time out on Film Sociology. Hopefully we can get you in Indianapolis sometime, but can't wait to see you on the telly.
Hey, listen, you've got my number. You call me anytime, and don't forget, any action movie you want, I'm in.
Oh, that's good. I'm glad you didn't say other kinds of video nasties or anything like that.
There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Matt's first conversation with Food Network Chef Robert Irvine. And a word to the wise. If you say call me anytime, he will. Don't threaten Matthew Soucy with a good time. And now, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
On behalf of Matthew Soucy, I am Kobe Slagle. Go see a good movie. You deserve it. You have been listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. Good night, Fort Myers. We'll see you next week. Good night, California. We'll see you tomorrow. We gone.